And now for something completely different.
Welcome to Shout Out. Out of the closet and into your ears.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Shout Out as we take a look inside the cast report. We'll be talking to Susie Green, who's part of Mermaid and Gender GP, and Cher Kofi, who's station manager of Medway Pride and a trans activist. Also, we'll be talking to therapist Tara Fraser to get her report on the fallout of the report. All that and more coming today right here on Shout Out.
Right, the trans issue seems to be going on and on and on. It's just been made so much worse by the current incumbents in number 10. A lot of prejudice out there. When you look back at when this started, I guess from my point of view, it would be Brexit that triggered hatred. People seem to come out of the closet and feel empowered to be hateful and hurtful. And this has continued, like I said, with no great help from the incumbents in number 10. We've got obviously huge pylons from J.K. Rowling, who seems just obsessed, absolutely obsessed. It's like she gets up in the morning and just, what can I say that's hurtful and hateful to trans women? And it's funny how it's just aimed at trans women. Trans men seem to be a bit irrelevant to her. I'm joined by Cher Kofi and Susie Green. So first of all, Susie.
I contacted Mermaids when my daughter, who's now 30, was six. So it was one of the only organisations. I worked in IT. I had no knowledge at all of trans kids. And my daughter said to me that God had made a mistake and she was really a girl. So I sought support, and one of the things that came up on my very ancient now computer with a modem that did that hissing sound as you connected up was Mermaids. And I spoke to they'd been going about 6 years at this point, but it was tiny, and I spoke to one of the founders and quickly got involved more as a parent of the parents group. Then I became a trustee, then I became chair. But the charity was very small, no paid staff at all for many, many years. So it was in 2016, beginning of 2016, January the 1st, that I became the first ever staff member as the CEO. And I think there was about 3 months worth of money to pay my salary in the bank. And that was it. So it was a bit of a leap of faith leaving my previous role, which I'd been in for over like nearly 15 years. So I didn't start it, but I certainly moved it from being a very small voluntary organization into what it is now, which is like circa 2 million income, lots of staff and a much, much bigger organization. So. But yeah, that's where I come from, and it's basically because I recognised the amount of prejudice that was out there, and also the lack of any kind of information about trans kids for parents to support them, to support their children. So that was really my focus and my impetus to try and get something going that provided that peer network, that peer support network, and support. And a listening ear. That's where I came from.
Okay. Shay, what gave you the idea? Why did you want to start your own radio station?
Someone suggested it to me, and I wasn't quick enough to come up with some reasons to not do it. Yeah, it grew.
Now, I would call you a trans activist, because you're out there, you've put your head well above the parapet, and like I said, you've been shot at quite a few times now, and you're still standing, and you're still fighting back. Let's get straight into the nitty-gritty. The CAS report, when it came out, looked conciliatory at first read, and then when you start digging below the surface, you think, well, there's quite a few holes in here, you know, that don't, you know, add up. Did you feel the same? Did you think, oh, this is quite a conciliatory tone? And then when you dug into it, you found it a little bit shallow?
Yeah. I had concerns before CAS came out, so I wasn't terribly taken in, if I'm honest. Everybody's looking at CAS from different angles. And for me, it's very much who was met and who was spoken to in the information gathering. And we now know that people like Patrick Hunter, who is a leading light in America's Catholic Medical Association, was spoken to and has given evidence. And he has very heavy links to Ron DeSantis and what's going on in Florida. And once you start to dissect Cass, it very much, very quickly becomes sometimes a plagiarism of what's been written word for word in Florida bills. So it's problematic. It's not terribly conciliatory. And I think it's going to cause a lot of hurt.
Susie, what was your first take on the report?
I think I was similar to Shay in terms of I knew it was not going to be good. I didn't expect it to be as bad as it is. And I agree, you know, the wording and the stuff is very reminiscent of what's coming out of, you know, states in Florida that are banning trans healthcare. But as soon as the actual report landed, because we saw a sort of like a summary the day before, and that looked reasonable. But then actually when you get the actual document itself, now I haven't gone through all 388 pages or whatever it is, but I know people who are cleverer than me who have, but I have picked up on some of the most significant things in there, and basically you're right, it's already caused a huge amount of pain and distress and hurt. It's had implications from the minute it landed. You know, the NHS immediately pulled back on prescribing puberty blockers. Scotland followed yesterday by saying that for under 18s they wouldn't be prescribing. And I'm on a lot of parents groups, as you would expect from like the years and years that I've worked in this field. And I'm on a lot of parents groups, and I am seeing just panic. People are panic stricken. And you know, when you talk about the distress caused by Cass, it basically is another layer on top of what happened with, you know, the Bell versus Tavistock. So Bell versus Tavistock, when that decision was handed down, when that judgment was handed down on the 1st of December 2020, NHS within 2 hours stopped all clinical work for under, you know, the Tavistock JID service just stopped. So the NHS were waiting to stop this. This looks very much like a, you know, yeah, this is it. This is an opportunity. We'll take this one. We'll stop treating and looking after young people. And then even when it was overturned, things never returned back to normal. But I've spoken to a clinician from inside that service who was very, very worried, concerned about what was happening with the CAS report. And when they said they were closing JIDs, they were very clear that this stuff that happened from Bell forwards and also the CAS review was going to cost people their lives. And I know I constantly am told, oh, don't talk about suicide. You mustn't talk about suicide. You mustn't talk about self-harm. But this is something that needs reiterating. Up until the 1st of December 2020, when that judgment was handed down, this clinician told me in the 7 years that they had worked in that service, there was one death of a young person. And that was a young person who was on the waiting list. From when Bell was handed down to date until JIDs closed at the end of March this year, there's been 16 young people have died, have taken their own lives. Now, that is directly correlates to a restriction and a reduction in care. And so what CAS has done is going to kill kids. I'm sorry, but that's literally it. That is what's going to happen. It's honestly, it just breaks my heart.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of the things that were coming out around the CAS report were numbers, and they were comparing what it was like about 10 years ago, where there was about 50 a year, and that bumped up to 3,000. And that turned turtle as well, because it was mainly those born female at birth. Now, do you see those figures as quite startling, or do you think that they're the narrow band where they took those numbers from gives us a wrong perspective?
I think you've got to take a little bit of a step back from this and just look at like the population as is. And if you even look at 0.5% of people within within our population are trans, and then you look at 3,000 and you go, that's nothing. That's absolutely nothing. Every trans person was a trans kid. Every trans adult was a trans kid at some point in their lives. So if you look at 3,000, that's nothing. That's literally the tip of the iceberg in terms of the numbers of trans kids that are out there. And I think the problem that we've got is we're not looking at this from the right perspective. We're not looking at this from actually 3,000 is too low. So what about those other kids? Why aren't they accessing support? Is it because they're in families that don't support them? Is it because they wouldn't be able to access it because they don't know that the service exists? So you wouldn't, I mean, maybe even the amount of absolute vitriol that's shoved at the trans community means that even though they know that it's there, they daren't actually seek help for their children because they know that the stigma and censure is so high. So actually you should be looking at it and going, it's only 3,000. What about all those other kids who aren't accessing support? Though in actual fact, what was happening over the last, 4 or 5 years as the waiting list grew and grew and went, now in excess of 4 years as JIDS closed, is that's not care. That's not treatment anyway. The inside the service, because there were gender critical clinicians as well as those that were hugely, that were supportive, people were finding that their progress was so slow and their kids were waiting ages to be seen. And then when they were seen, they were on a process that took up to sometimes up to 44 appointments before they were referred for endocrinology for any kind of medical assistance. So it was failing them anyway. But what's happening now is so much worse.
There was a lot of other movement on Twitter and other social media about how a lot of the problem was down to GPs just pushing people forward without giving a holistic approach. And so what they were saying, instead of looking at maybe what was surrounding that child's makeup, they just thought, right, they've said the word gender, let's get them off of my books and onto what they saw as a specialist. Do you think that GPs weren't doing their job? Do you think that they were just passing the buck?
It's supporting somebody with gender dysphoria, supporting somebody through that journey in terms of giving them access to therapeutic support that understands their particular circumstances, but also, a pathway into medical treatment if they want it, if it's applicable, because for some it's not appropriate. That's not really a GP's job anyway, if that's done right. But GPs see people for all sorts of different things. But my understanding, from what I've seen, when I was at Mermaids, we did a study on what GPs were like with people who were trans, young people and adults. And actually, so many were literally totally obstructive, would not support us all in any way, even to do a referral into the Tavistock JIDS service. So this expectation that they're just rushing people through is nonsense. It doesn't happen. But then even if they were referred to JIDS, they sat on a waiting list for years, literally years. So to say that people were rushed through a system and then dumped out the other, it's just nonsense. It's nothing to do with the actual reality of what was happening.
Shay, onto puberty blockers, and you see what's happening around the world, like Spain, Germany, and recently Sweden and that. And it's almost like we've put a wall up around our little island, and the CAST report seems to have ignored everything that's going on in the world and all the data. There must be thousands and thousands of pieces of data around trans kids out there, and it's like they're just totally ignoring it. What's your take on that, and how the rest of the world seems to be going, or European countries, progressive European countries, and the way that the UK seems to be ignoring that?
Well, the bulk of the data is largely supportive of puberty blockers. Countries that are moving forward that you say are progressive, they have reams of data. I believe that the NHS started using puberty blockers in 1989. So there is evidence within the NHS as well. It's, we're talking 35 years of evidence here. A lot of that was actually discarded from CAS and was considered not available to be used. The idea and the way some of the data has been collated, and this whole double blind issue, which largely affects it's ensuring that data that is relevant is just from the word go discarded. And we look at other countries, we look at the progressive European models, and the kids are happy and the kids are healthy, and there isn't the evidence to suggest on the whole that puberty blockers are as damaging as has been laid claim to in the CATH report. And to pick up one of Susie's points, I know we don't want to talk about kids, you know, the fact that kids are dying, but one of the reasons I got into this was because we were running the radio station and I have a trans child and their best friend was also transgender. And 2 days before Christmas 2022, they committed suicide. And they committed suicide because there was, as they saw it, no hope, no chance of moving forward. So we not only had to support friends from the loss of their child, but we had to support our child and try and rebuild their life. And this idea that there is nothing out there that these kids can go to and can get advice and can get support, we're just going, oh, it doesn't exist, lala. It, you know, it doesn't exist in this country, it exists everywhere else, and we appreciate that, but let's get that Brexit wall up and let's get that information denied. And the kids that are casualties in all this are just that. And some of the language that I've heard used is very reminiscent of Boris Johnson's alleged let the bodies pile high when COVID happened. It's almost like it's a solution to things rather than the problem itself. Yeah, we could do with more evidence on puberty blockers, but hey, there's only one way we're going to get that, isn't there? And that's by following the data in other countries and saying, okay, we can do this. If Spain can do this, we can do this.
Hmm. Indeed. And very recently, Sweden lowering the age. And like I said, it's like this country or the politicians are just ignoring the rest of the world and the data that is out there. Do you think, Susie, that we're hedging more towards the Florida model and what DeSantis is trying to do? And widening that, do you think that religion, as in the States, is having more of an impact in this country?
I think you need to look at where the challenges are coming from and the links from the organizations who are pushing this anti-trans narrative and this agenda, where they're linked to. You know, the lawyer for the Bell versus Tavistock case is you know, is very much an anti-abortion lawyer and has brought cases to try and get abortion banned. You know, so this is all of this is built into removing autonomy. And I think they're attacking the thin end of the wedge in terms of trans people because they can make progress in that. I mean, obviously when Bell versus Tavistock was overturned, the judges actually made statements saying the first judges were completely remiss because they were taking away competency and, you know, overlooking Gillett competency completely for those young people, and that it's not up to the state, it's not up to the legal state, certainly, to be making decisions about people's healthcare. That's between, you know, that's between the young person, their parents, and the clinician themselves. So this should not be within state jurisdiction. And that's again, just getting pushed to one side, isn't it? We know the narrative's coming from the far right. We know that this is, you know, there's definitely religion. And yes, it's definitely going down the same route as the anti-trans bills that are happening. You know, Idaho passed one a few days ago that was the horrendous Florida, the way that's going, you know. So yeah, definitely. I think there's a lot of money coming across the pond to fund this. And I think the thing is that really upsets me at the baseline of all of this, all of these people who have got massive issues with trans kids and do they exist? Not, they don't have trans kids. Or if they do, then they're completely denying their existence, and they don't talk to their kids anymore because their kids won't have anything to do with them because their parents are bigots. So, you know, I just think if this doesn't affect you personally and you have no knowledge of the distress and the pain caused by what has been actioned here, then why do you think you should have a voice about what other people's kids, young people do and how they move forward? Why is it any of your business? And that's the bit I just can't get, because it doesn't affect those people. Why do they think that they've got a say? And why have they got such a passion for overriding trans kids' rights in particular? And I think the baseline of all of this is bigotry. And it just really, it upsets me to see how far it's gone into like Parliament and other areas where this is, you know, being misrepresented. And the victims, as Shay has pointed out, the victims are the kids and the families and the distress caused.
Yeah. Looking from outside of our country, and you look at countries like Spain, which is very Catholic, and yet they've given self-determination to trans people. And yet you look at Italy, which is just as Catholic, and yet it's gone the other way. So maybe that's pointing to, like you say, a minority of politicians pushing their own agenda, because Spain is no less Catholic than Italy, and yet they've gone in different directions. And there's still the right wing in Spain, as there are with many other countries, but they seem to be able to control them in certain countries. And when you think how liberal German is got, and yet next door, Poland and Slovakia are very right wing and anti-LGBTQ. And it wasn't long ago that Poland had towns that were banning anyone queer from going in them until the EU said, well, you're not getting any more money. And money obviously trumped those signs, which quickly came down. So there is lots of prejudice, but there are glimmers of hope, at least around Europe. And even in the States, there's glimmers of hope where states are fighting back against those, I would even say, almost fascist states. I would say Florida is a fascist state now. In fact, I would say Florida is more fascist than the fascist government in Italy, because I think Meloni in Italy is not turning out to be as hateful. She is anti-LGBTQ, but she doesn't seem to be doing it in such a hateful way that DeSantis is doing in the States and a lot of the right-wing religions. Shay, your take on the world politics and how different countries and religion is affecting that?
Religion is always a cloak. There are always going to be people that will dress themselves up in the righteousness of religion to enact bigotry. And that doesn't matter whether we're talking about Catholics or Protestants or Jews or Muslims. There are always going to be firebrand activists who use religion as some kind of, well, they weaponize it, don't they? Let's be honest. Any religion you care to look at will tell you, you know, essentially you strip away everything and it's be nice to your neighbor. It's have compassion, have sympathy, have empathy. And it's interesting that the people who use religion in a political sense never seem to have those things. They never seem to have empathy for the kids. They never seem to have sympathy for the families. And to be honest, religion needs to stay out of this. This is something that is more science-based, and we don't need religious evidence in this. We need the science evidence, the scientific evidence, and that all points in our direction. That all points that care of trans kids, and it doesn't necessarily mean puberty blockers. It doesn't necessarily mean hormones or going as far as surgeries, because they might not want that. But it does mean that you have to, if someone comes to you and says, I'm trans, you start from the point of view where you believe them. Mm. And that's the important bit here, that young lives feel that they're not going to end because they've got no support, that there is someone out there who will listen and take on board what the kids are saying. And where are the detransitioners in all this? If we've got this so wrong, where are the 1,000 families that on the 11th of August were blazoned across the Times that were going to sue Tavistock? Where are they?
I don't know if any.
Why haven't they come forward?
Yeah, And this is it as well, because I was hearing on the radio every hour on the radio yesterday, they were saying things like, you know, that Scotland has banned puberty blockers and all of these children have been failed by being prescribed them. Have they spoken to any of those young people? Have they spoken to those young people and their families? Is that what the families think, that they've been failed? In fact, it's utterly the opposite. You know, it's the opposite. Those families whose kids managed to get puberty blockers, to get prescribed puberty blockers, they are completely and totally happy with the treatment and what their children. And, you know, I know many of them, and they talk about the fact that you know, their kids' lives have been made so much better by being able to access timely treatment. So, you know, they're saying they're being failed. Where's the evidence of that? Because actually, that's not what the families and the young people are saying at all. This is what the politicians are saying. Because they're building, you know, they're stoking a culture war to basically try to distract from the fact that they've completely and utterly screwed up our country.
Mm. I was chatting to somebody at the BCFM studios who is not part of the LGBTQIA community, but asking questions because they were just interested in knowing more, and that they'd be more understanding the more they knew, which is quite nice. But they were quite confused over this huge umbrella term that's relatively new to somebody, especially of my age, transgender. And they didn't realize that it covered such a huge gamut. They were focused on what, when I was growing up, was transsexual. And so that confused them when you then said, right, in my day, there was like cross-dressers, transvestites, there was transsexuals. But non-binary were either tomboys or sisses, obviously a derogatory term for young boys growing up. It's always derogatory for boys because you had to man up. Now, do you think that the umbrella term transgender is caused more of an issue because there is such a huge gamut of meaning? Or do you think that's made things better in that it encompasses everybody on the spectrum?
I was talking to Mike Jackson of Lesbians and Gay Support the Minors a couple of years ago. And we had a long chat, and he said to me at one point, he said, you know, I've been in schools and I've been an activist for 40 years. And I go into schools these days and the kids talk about stuff that I don't understand. He's like, I don't understand these terms. I don't get it. I can't keep up. Isn't it brilliant? Isn't it brilliant? And he went on to say that 40 years ago, he couldn't have imagined a community where there would be these options, where you could explain yourself clearly and concisely. And he thought it was wonderful. And the world moves very, very fast, particularly when you get over the age of 40. And it brings back this whole idea of, are we talking about our youth or are we talking about their youth? And are we talking about who they are or who we thought we were? And one of the things that has come across when I've been working with LGBT young people as a whole is how much I learn from them. And I think that's a really important point in all this, that they're the ones that are going to be the lawmakers, the doctors, the citizens of the future. So we need to be listening to them a bit more.
Mm. Do you think a lot could be done just by having a more caring society? As in, if you think that everyone was okay with anyone who's LGBTQIA+, and society just thought, oh, it's okay, it's different, I don't understand it, but live and let live. Do you think at one fell swoop that would cut suicide rates, depression amongst the whole of the queer community, Susie?
Wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice if everybody just minded their own business and were just kind, just kind to people? Wouldn't it be great? You know, you don't need to understand. I mean, I've had so many conversations with people where they go, I just don't get that non-binary thing. And my view is, it doesn't matter. Mm. All you need to do is respect the person and listen to what they say and respect that they're telling you their truth. And that's it. And you don't have to understand it. You don't have to interrogate it. And you certainly, nobody should be in a position where they can turn around and go, well, because I don't understand it, that means that you're not allowed to be yourself. How is that okay? How is that okay for any of us? You know, in terms of, you know, in terms of your ability to live, to be yourself, to feel confident, to feel seen, heard, respected, you know, just because somebody else might not understand that, that surely shouldn't mean that that's like not allowed as such. I mean, what nonsense. Everybody, you know, deserves the right to live their lives and be seen and be heard and respected, as long as they're reasonable people. Some people, maybe not so much.
Shay, the two clinics that they said we're going to open to replace the Tavistock's not happening. It's been put back because either the excuse is they haven't got the staff, they haven't got the knowledge base. Do you see that moving forward, or do you see it just a red herring that the politicians, the current politicians, just don't care?
I don't see it moving forward. I'd like to be more hopeful. It's not going to move forward under the current colour government we've got, and it won't, I believe, move forward very much under a Labour government. I think anything that is proposed at this point will be attacked and pulled apart and lied about and scapegoated. I think it's going to be very difficult in the medium term, the next 4 or 5 years, to get anything constructive done. And in the meantime, we have kids and they are desperate. They are believing they're alone. They are believing that nobody cares. They are believing that what we've got is insurmountable. And the truth is that we're one of the richest nations in the world, and we could get this problem solved. We could get this across the line overnight, with a little bit of understanding and a little bit of belief that actually, if you've got trans adults, by the very definition, there has to have been a time when you had trans kids. It's nothing new. It's nothing that just popped up in the last 6 or 7 years, as the myth would go. And we need to be supporting our trans community right the way through, from cradle to grave. And that's not going to change in the near future, which is probably why people like myself and Susie will keep screaming and shouting and yelling and making trouble, because it's what we're really good at.
It does leave me quite aghast when you hear or you see written in social media from people that should know better that it's a social contagion, and that is like you just wake up one morning and think, oh, I'm trans all of a sudden. And yet you go back before Christianity and Islam and look at the Native American Indians who revered Two-Spirit. It's like we're going backwards and people are just making up stories. What worries me is the fact that people could just blatantly lie, like Boris Johnson and Trump, but just blatantly lie and people will believe them. Is a frightening,
very much so.
Frightening world, I think, at the moment.
I clashed before Christmas with James Price, who is one of the authors of the school guidance. And it was on Radio 2. It got a little bit heated. And at one point, he described my trans child as a social contagion. Now, if one of the people writing the guidance for kids in schools who are transgender believes that that is indeed where we're at, what kind of guidance are we published?
Yeah, it's very worrying, very worrying. I don't know where all this is going to end up, and it frightens me a lot. And but we keep putting this subject out there on Shout Out, and we keep shouting and screaming about it and until we are heard. And like you, Shay, I'm not confident, overly confident, when the Labour Party get in. There's already been a few people who've opened their mouths and spoken a negative way, which worries me. And you think, well, you know, there's a lot of people putting a lot of faith in the Labour Party for all sorts of things, like taking us back into the EU, sorting out the issues with trans kids. And now I'm thinking maybe nothing's going to happen. It's going to be like a swap. If I don't know whether you can remember Blair getting in, it was almost like a slightly left-wing Tory party again. And nothing really changed. And that's what worries me, that the parties we have at the moment, that at least we won't have a fascist government in, but it worries me that, you know, we're not going to go far enough to compassion that we need to. 10 years ago, we, you know, when we were in the European Union, everything seemed fine. And I don't think in my worst nightmare I could have seen us leaving the EU, and I couldn't have seen Trump becoming president. And yet both those things happened in quick succession. And then I thought, oh, Boris Johnson will never get in, and he got in. So every time I had this thought about that can't possibly happen, it did. So all I can hope now is that with all those voices we have out there, like yours, Susie, and yours, Shay, that things will gradually improve over the years, and we will get back to where we were. The gay men went through Section 28 and they fought like hell. And I think this is an equivalence of where the trans community is fighting like hell for his existence. I think love and compassion will always win. And I truly believe that. And it might be a long fight, but I think that in the end, we will get there, especially when there's supportive countries out there all making the right decision, which must put pressure on a British government.
You would hope.
You would hope. Fingers.
Yeah.
Susie Green, Shay Coffey, we're completely out of time. Thank you so much for your time today, and we'll obviously have you on again, and when we know the next phase of the next government. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
This is Shout Out News. Welcome along.
LGBT plus newswire Pink News notes that the advocacy group Translucent has established via Freedom of Information requests that there has never been a single complaint about transgender women using hospital wards appropriate to their presenting gender. However, in an article published on Monday, the groundbreaking newswire revealed that sources close to the government were plotting and intensifying their cultural war against this tiny minority of the population by banning trans women from single-sex wards. Now, the details are somewhat murky and were sourced from the right-wing newspaper, The Daily Telegraph, which has a long tradition of homophobia as well as a fixation on transgender women. But a source close to the Conservative administration said that the health minister wanted to repeal trans-inclusive language and policies within the NHS. On the other hand, as the left-wing newspaper Socialist Worker pointed out in an editorial recently, along with the government's plans to force millions of disabled people off benefits and the proposed clampdowns on travellers and homeless people, all of this may come to nothing, given that a general election is due and given that the present government is breaking all parliamentary records in its unpopularity.
Exciting news from the largest lesbian and LGBT plus women's magazine in Europe or the UK, Diva. A new CEO takes over from early May. Nancy Kelly is a British lawyer, policy advisor and human rights advocate who served as the CEO of Stonewall from 2020 until July 2023. This year, she was made the director of Lesbian Visibility Week and has worked alongside organisations such as ILGA World, LGBT Foundation, Curve and more. In addition, Diva magazine will be registering as a charity, giving back to the community that has supported it over the last three decades. Diva's special 30th anniversary issue is out now and can be purchased from good LGBTQI plus friendly bookstores at www.divadirect.info/.
We know that many LGBTQIA plus people have children and that they make excellent parents. Indeed, some studies suggest that children have some advantages being brought up outside the heterosexual nuclear family. But what about heterosexual and cisgender people who do not want children? The BBC News Channel met up with members of the group Bristol Child Free Women to learn about cultural expectations and prejudices. BCW has over 500 members, women who have elected not to have children. Caroline Mitchell always knew she never wanted children, but she wasn't prepared for how hard-reaching childbearing age would be. The 46-year-old, who lives with her husband in the Brislington area, said while it never bothered her when she was younger, she had not anticipated the barrage of personal questions she would face as friends and acquaintances did start to have children. Shockingly, people who are childless have been accused of being selfish, of being not real women, which is significant as this phrase is stolen from extremist separatists who dislike trans women. And all of this judgment also seems strange when communities such as religious orders of celibate women have been celebrated as dutiful and caregiving for many centuries. Official figures released in 2022 show record numbers of women are reaching the age of 30 child-free. More than half of women in England and Wales born in 1990 were without a child when they turned 30 in 2020, the first generation to be so, according to the Office for National Statistics. Caroline said that she would be a resentful mother, adding that there were a huge amount of upsides to not having children, like focusing her time on her relationship with her husband and her hobbies. Another member of the group said, "There's a lot of joy to be had in not having kids. It isn't all about freedom and money. It's about choice."
Sources for court organisations and LGBT plus legal experts Lambda reports that a landmark ruling has been handed down by the United States Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals to say that gender identity is a protected characteristic. This will have great implications for future laws as it renders statewide bans on trans healthcare at the level of Republican-controlled state senates unconstitutional. The ruling says that trans people are a protected group under equal rights laws and that anti-trans discrimination is sex discrimination, thus overturning state bans on healthcare, which affirms trans identities. Justices told state attorneys that their arguments that anti-trans discrimination was not a violation of the Constitution because they applied to everyone, not just trans people, was not correct. And the judges cited the older rulings on same-sex marriage in their verdict. The judges said gender dysphoria is so intimately related to trans status as to be virtually indistinguishable from it. The excluded treatments aim at addressing incongruity between sex assigned at birth and gender identity, the very heart of transgender status. Ultimately, the court also ruled that exclusions on trans healthcare violate the equal protection provisions of the ACA legislation. ACA refers to Affordable Care Act, which was the national health plan implemented by the Obama administration. You can find more comprehensive coverage on this important ruling at the website of respected LGBT plus newspaper, The Washington Blade.
For Shout Out News, this has been Terry Starr.
And
that people have gone from, you know, when people go from youth service to adult service, there's also that there's no connection between those two either, or historically there hasn't been.
We will keep this subject up there.
Has to be, I'm afraid, until it gets resolved.
Yeah, I don't think this will be the last special we do on the trans community.
No.
And, we'll keep voicing and pushing back. As long as it goes. Thank you, Tara.
No problem. Take care.
That's it for this week's Shout Out special. If you have something to say, do email us, studio@shoutoutradio.lgbt. This week's show was produced by Steffi Barnett, news by Terry Starr. Big thanks go to Susie Green, Shia Kofi and Tara Fraser for their contributions. Until next week, I'm Ellie Shilton. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye. Shout Out.
LGBT radio for you.